Okay, why don't we go ahead and let's start, and then I got your message, Kelly, so I'll try to do that when I can.
I'm gonna add all the public attendees in.
Okay, let me know when that's done.
Okay, you're good to go.
Okay, we will now convene the regular and supplemental, and we are required to have a public meeting twice a year under the statute. So we're going to call that to order, then we will recess the regular and the supplemental meetings at this time. I want to make a couple of quick notes or announcements. Chuck Campbell, who is our outside attorney for Jackson Walker, our fiduciary counsel, is on the phone with us today, so all the trustees will know that, and he's available for whatever questions. Also, Jerry Rhodes, who frequently attends our meetings, at least when we're in person, has been awarded the Reserve Officer of the Year Award by Dallas Police Fire Department, Dallas Police Department. So, you're on. Congratulations. If not, we'll just indicate that in the record. So, I'm glad to hear you. I'm sure it was well-deserved. Now we will move to our next item, which is... Jeff and Caitlin are going to give us the actuarial evaluation report.
All right, thank you. Let's go ahead and scroll to page 5, please. Oh, I'm sorry. Two more. I forgot the page number. There we go. Sorry. I forgot the page number. So the main... takeaways from the evaluation this year. One was the experience study, if you recall. We completely overhauled the assumptions of the plan, effective with the 2020 evaluation. Also, asset performance. The plan, I'm skipping a little bit around. The plan return had a return of 6.25 on a market value basis, the way we calculated for 2019, and a little over 5% on an actuarial basis. Now, 6.25 was, much less than most of our other plans on a calendar year, but obviously you're dealing with other issues. Most plans are not unwinding from some of your asset positions. So those are some of the takeaways. For the actual incurring contribution, for 2020 is a little over $170 million, and that's based on a 30-year amortization as required by Texas code. It's no greater than 30-year amortization. The unfunded liability, which last year was projected to be fully funded in 2057, is now projected to be fully funded in 2075. So, it was 38 years last year to full funding and 55 years this year. And the single largest component of the reason why that got pushed out is that the interim asset returns, for the projections, we're using returns that are less than the discount rate for the next several years. In last year's report, the asset return for calendar 2020 was projected to be 5.75%. The updated return we were given this year was -6% for 2020. So that change of 11.75 basis points had an 11-year impact on the full funding projection. That one change up front has a big impact. Other reasons why the assumptions pushed it out a couple of years, and then just the small experience loss for the year. But the overriding reason for that, pushing out from 38 to 55 years, from 2057 to 2075, was the change in asset return for 2020. So
because we're starting with the lower base?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, and now also part of those 18-year differential is there are assumption changes as well that did have an impact, but the single largest impact was the upfront, the 2020 expected return. So the actual return contribution as I mentioned, $170 million for 2020. That's up $17.9 million from last year. The assumptions were the largest part of that increase, along with investment loss and just other small gains and losses, the net impact of those. The actual contributions in 2019 were $155.7 million, which was actually slightly greater than the actual determined contribution. But a little bit less than we expected. We were expecting closer to $157.8 million, which is what we've been using in our projections, you know, based on the 26 pay period of $13 million. I know the pay periods differ over the calendar year, so it's not going to impact, but it's a little bit less than we use in our projections. And we're expecting somewhere in the neighborhood of $162 million in contributions from the city in calendar 20. So the funded ratios at the bottom of the screen, they dropped from 48.1 on an actual basis to 45.73, and on a market basis from 45.43 down to 43.56. And let's see, looking at those. The assumption changes, and we went through this, of course, during the experience study a couple months ago, but the assumption changes were the largest reason for the funded percentage to drop. That was not an unexpected drop. We could go to the next page, please. And please jump in at any time. I'm just going to keep going unless someone, you know, jumps in with questions. So the actuarial assets remained level, $2.16 billion. There was a small increase in the market value of assets. As we mentioned, the market return is 6.25%, actuarial return was 5.05%. That was compared against an assumption of 7.25%. One of the assumption changes in the 2020 experience study was we lowered the discount rate from 7.25% to 7%. You know, along with the discount rate, some of the assumptions listed below, the salary scale, the payroll growth rate, mortality, retirement, drop interest rate, withdrawal. I mean, pretty much it was an overhaul of any assumption that had any sort of impact on the plan. And that's not unusual. Every 5 years, we kind of reset the experience study. You know, payroll growth, agreements that the police and fire have with the city, you know, we update based on those. Mortality tables were updated. Your retirement patterns have stabilized a little bit from a couple of years ago, but you know, we still update those, the drop interest rate changes. So it's not unusual to have these type of wholesale changes every few years when you do an experience study. After the experience study, the ad hoc COLA, the COLA timing was updated as well. If we can skip to the next page, please. We can go to the next page.
Can you skip to the next, go to the next page?
Yeah, thanks, John. So you can see just a small summary of how the actual determined contribution changed. You know, it was, like I said, $152.1 million last year. Prior to any assumption changes, it had been $157.6 million. And then the assumption changes had a $12.4 million impact on the actual determined contribution. So the next page, as just a summary of the, and you'll see a table similar to this in the actual valuation report. If anyone has questions that are in the valuation report you may have seen that's not addressed here, you know, please bring them up. This is just a high-level summary. You can see the normal cost is a percent of pay. A little bit from 16.69 to 17.4. That's primarily the assumption changes. But, you know, the employees, the members are contributing about 13.5%. So the employer, the city's normal cost actually is pretty low. You know, under 4% is pretty low for the city's normal cost. But, you know, that's not driving the cost, obviously. It's going to fund stability is where the contributions are coming in, covering that increase from $2.3 billion to a little under $2.6 billion. So as mentioned earlier, contribution, $152 million last year, under $170 this year, with the year full funding being pushed out from 2057 to 2075. So Caitlin's going to go, if you're going to go to the next page, please, John. Caitlin's going to go over a little bit of the data and asset returns and some of the historical information.
Thanks, Jeff. This slide here outlines some of the demographic shifts from last year's valuation to this year. Of note is really the increase in the active population is up about a little over 2%, and it's actually the 5,121 as the valuation date is the highest level since 2015. Obviously, from 2015, things took a decline for a couple of years. They're starting to come back up a little bit. Average pay amongst the active members of $77,000. About a 7% decrease over increase over last year, driven by the double step pay increases that went into effect for everybody either in the end of 2018 or through 2019. In addition, the number of active drop members declined almost 21%, I think it was, as that population continues to kind of retire, and we're not seeing a lot of more people come into the drop, so it's mainly people coming out. We expect that to continue to come down. For the number of participants in pay status, also saw about a little over 2% increase with an average monthly benefit of $4,250. It was also a small increase over last year. On the bottom there, just the number of inactive vested members up there also went up a little bit, but that's a much smaller piece of your liabilities there. Let's go to the next page for me. It's just a graph with your historical asset returns since 2008. As noted at the bottom, I would say I had 2012 and 2015 have the effect of different changes in the asset method, but you also have returns in 2014 and 2015 were drastically affected by significant write-downs in the plan assets. We've got a pretty big negative number there in 2015. We kind of focused just on the last 4 years, though. You'll see that's kind of where we reset that asset method, and you'll see your teal line, that's the actual return, has been a little more stable over that period compared to the market value. And kind of the whole goal of obviously asset smoothing is to get some more stable results as the market kind of fluctuates up and down. On the next page. This year, just for the last 10 years, it's a history of both the actuarial accrued liability in the green bars, and then you also have the actuarial value and market value of assets in the two lines. Kind of similar to the prior page, you can see that the assets had pretty big write-downs from 2014 and 2016. You also have a pretty large drop in actuarial accrued liability from 2016 to 2017. That was just due to the large number of drop payments that were made that year, that liability coming out of the plan, but also those assets coming out of the plan. This year is just noted a small uptick in the actual accrued liability from $4.5 billion to $4.7 billion, mainly driven by those assumption changes, including the lowering the discount rate by 25 basis points.
Hey, Caitlin, this is Kelly. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Didn't the wasn't a big reason for the decline in the actuarial accrued liability? Did that was that impacted by the legislative change as well as the drop assets?
Correct. Yes. Also the plan changes.
Thank you.
Sort of the next page. Just a similar history to the funded percentage over the last 10 years. See from 2014 to 2016 is kind of where you see the big drop, the 20-point decline. Again, tied to the reasons mentioned before, you had the write-down in the assets. They're mainly driving the lower funded percentage, and really remained stable since that point. And although there was a small decline this year due to the assumption changes mentioned, it's pretty relatively stable over the last 5 years compared to the prior five. The next page then is just discussion on some risks, actually tied to an ASOP, that actuarial standard practice that went into effect recently we included discussion of Bridgetown in all of our actual communications, and we've kind of just keyed on three main ones here. Obviously, investment risk is something that faces any fund and something not unfamiliar to this plan, as the system's assets are still expected to earn less than the assumed 7% rate over the next 2 years as that investment portfolio is balanced. As Jeff mentioned, particularly the lower return expected for 2020 is a main driver in that fully funded date as we're looking into the future. Beyond that, the investment portfolio being rebalanced, obviously, even in a normal year, any time that you're getting returns above or below what you're expected, you're going to see kind of swings in that fully funded date and your funded percentage. And really, given the way the plan is made up, it's very mature. Your benefit payments far outweigh your contribution income. So absent investments to make up that gap, you're going to draw down on your assets. And so there's always going to be a risk that in years you're getting lower investment income, that contributions are not going to be enough to cover the benefit payments coming out of the fund. In addition to investment risk, there's also risk in our demographic assumptions and longevity. You know, we have a set of assumptions that are our best estimate, and we're obviously reviewed this year in the experience study, but there's still obviously the risk that actual experience will be different than expected. Example, with longevity or the mortality assumption, if members live longer than we've expected and anticipated, then benefit payouts are going to go on for a longer period and be higher than we're assuming, which obviously will draw down on the system's assets sooner than expected. The final bullet here, contribution risk, kind of leads into the next few slides. Obviously, the plan contributions are set by the statute now, and dollars are dependent on computation pay. The next few slides that Jeff's going to go over are going to kind of cover the importance of accurate payroll projections. Right now, we're using the city's hiring plan in years that differs from our kind of expected valuation pay. And I'll kind of think you can go to the next page, then we'll talk more about that and the impact that could have.
All right. Yeah, thank you. So when we're talking about, I've been talking about the projected full funding date going from 2057 to 2775. That's based on the city's hiring plan payroll projections. So it is extremely important that those payroll projections come to bear, because the projections give vastly different results if you're using the hiring plan projections versus just evaluation plan projections projected at 2.5%. So if we can go on the next page. Thank you. So for the first 4 years, valuation payroll is cumulatively $51.5 million less than the city's projections. And when we're talking about valuation payroll, it's not for the valuation payroll for 2020 is not just what was paid in 2019. It's what was paid in 2019 with a year of salary scale projected to what the active participants are expected to earn in 2020. So for the first 4 years of the valuation payroll, those it's $51.5 million cumulatively less. And that's a big difference. Obviously, there's a floor on contributions through 2024. You know, beginning of 2025, I mean, based solely on pay, the city's 34.5% and the participants 13.5%. So the differences on that can be large. If you look at the blue box at the bottom, if we took the valuation payroll, $397 million, and we increase that by 2.5% each year, which is the updated payroll growth assumption based on the study, ignoring the city's hiring plan projection, if we just based on the payroll growth, instead of 100% projected in 2075, the plan would be 41% projected funded. That's huge. That's a huge differential, obviously, from 100% to 41%. And that's just based on the payroll plan projection coming to bear or not. If we can go to the next page and put some numbers to it a little bit better. So you can see 2020. Now, it is worth pointing out, in 2020, our payroll projections for valuation are actually a little bit greater than the city's hiring plan payroll. You know, as Caitlin mentioned, there's been an uptick in active membership, and hopefully that'll continue, and continue that the valuation payroll projections at least equal the city's hiring plan. But what you see here in the column labeled the projected valuation payroll, it's a 2.5% increase based on the 396 moving forward. And you can see going down through 2037, there's a cumulative difference of the city's hiring plan and just the current payroll projected 2.5% each year. It's a cumulative difference of over $806 million. So that's the difference between being 100% funded and 41% funded is the contributions on the differences in payroll with the income they would earn based on this contribution.
Jeff, what is driving the difference? Is it the number of offices, or is it what their payroll plan have a higher increase than 2.5%?
It's just the difference in it's headcount primarily. I mean, the headcount's been less over the last few years than what the hiring plan payroll assumed to have, or at least I don't know if they put a number headcount or just they came up with a payroll. I assume they did with a projected headcount. But the headcount increased this year, which is why the valuation payroll, they finally fell into the hiring plan payroll. So if the headcount continues, also continue to increase, but if it stays at the level and the pay raises come to bear, now, obviously, if actual pay raises, there's different, of course, different level of pay raises depending on position, but if cumulative pay raises are less than 2.5% on average, then yes, it's not going to catch up. But we need those pay raises to really exceed the 2.5% on average, and also we need the headcount, really. If the headcount increases enough, then regardless of what the pay raises are, we need the headcount so the pay equals or exceeds the city's hiring plan projection.
Hey, Jeff, is it true that the city's hiring plan estimate includes I thought it was 3.09 or maybe 3.10% increase over time in their payroll, and we're assuming a 2.5, so that's part of the problem?
Right. The pay plans in place just don't allow really for a reasonable assumption that's going to be 3% long-term. I mean, hopefully that it will come to bear. Obviously, the increases in this valuation were, I think it was 7%, Caitlin said, but, you know, there was the double step that phrases came into play there. So that's not going to be an annual type thing. We don't expect a 7% increase in average pay each year. That'd be great for the members, but, you know, I think that's just not a reasonable expectation. But that sounds right. If we do this, I'm doing my calculator real quick. Yeah, it's right about 3% average increase from the $372 million starting point to the $684 million. So that is greater than the assumption. So we need, if the increases aren't going to average at least 3% per year, we need the headcount at a higher level than they anticipated so that the total payroll exceeds it. If you have lower active participant base, then you need the higher increases, or if you have a higher base, then you can have lower increases as long as the total payroll is met.
Why would we have a 2.5% assumption if the city is at 3.1? I mean, do we know something different? Or, I mean, would seem we would, our best estimate would be what they think they're going to pay increases, no?
Well, I mean, with the 2.5% came from the experience study and looking at the pay plans agreed to with the members and prior experience. So, correct me, and I'm not trying to speak, I don't want this to come out poorly, but I think when they came up with my recollection with the hiring plan payroll, that was a pretty quick determination and a break in negotiation. I'm not, I mean, obviously they have a better idea for headcounts and hiring plans than I do for the fire police. But I think there's a little more time involved in hours putting it together. For the past, going back to the experience study, which I had pulled up on my one of my monitors, for the past from 21 January 2015 to January 2020, the valuation payroll increased an average of 0.73%. Now, obviously, three of those years saw pretty big drops in active membership, and we expect that to come back up, and hopefully that'll continue on the uptick. But look at the actual raises, looking at the proposed rates, which range from 2.5% to 3.25% over the next the three-year agreement or four-year agreement, I think, 2020 through 2022, and then 2023 on. I know it gets renegotiated every few years. But the bulk of folks have a 2.5% increase. You know, for certain members, there's a 3 or 3.25 for the next 3 years proposed rate. But on average, it's going to be barely over 2.5% for the based on the current agreement.
And one of the things I'd like to add is just a reminder that what we call the city's hiring plan is really not a hiring plan that I would think the city would say is their hiring plan. What this is, and Jeff mentioned it, was when we were doing the legislation in 2017, they came up with these numbers of this is the city's hiring plan, and the legislation was based on this. I do not know what the city's current plans are for hiring or what they expect to pay in the future other than what we've seen in the meet and confer agreement, but I would bet that this is not their hiring plan. But what we do is we use these numbers because that was what the legislation was based on, and that's kind of our anchor point. And we have really, you know, we're relying on and that as we go forward, unless we have some reason to tell us these aren't good numbers. And right now the city is making and has made good progress towards getting to these numbers. They just need to, you know, continue that progress. They can't let off.
Yeah, just the current meet and confer agreement doesn't lend itself to supporting a 3% plus average return.
Well, Ellie, I think we need to dig into this with the city next year and try to firm this up and see what the real numbers should be. If it is 3%, our funding status is a lot better than what this valuation is showing us.
Well, actually, well, this valuation is using the city's hiring plan, which I think is a 3.09, right, is what we're using in the valuation. And the warning sign is if we don't meet these numbers, then it would be worse.
Right. So, and just a slight clarification, it wouldn't impact the funded status like an evaluation, but it would impact the projected full funding date. But
right.
On the next John, would you skip to the next page, please? So on this one, this is just showing the projected path full funding for the hiring plan and evaluation payroll. And you can see an evaluation payroll, you know, that funded percentage dips below 20% for a couple of years. And we said all along that the funded percentage, you know, regardless of which of these payroll projections comes to bear, the funded percentage will go down before it starts coming back up. All things being equal, if you meet all your assumptions every year, no gains or losses, all the contributions are made exactly as expected, which, you know, of course, none of that ever happens. But all things being equal, we expect the funded percentage to drop down before it comes back up. That's not unexpected. I hate bringing that up as a reminder, but I want to make sure everyone understands that, that is the expectation. So it's not unexpected that it's dipping down. Even without the assumption changes, it would have dropped down a little bit. It wouldn't have dropped down as much, but it still would have dropped down the funded percentage. And that's another thing. The assumptions will be looked at, I'm sure, every 5 years. That will have an impact. Usually assumption changes add cost, not always. I've done experience studies where the cost is lowered due to the assumption changes. just depends on what assumptions needed to be changed. Any plan changes will, of course, impact this. Asset returns. I mean, this is kind of our best guess that based on the information we have and the assumptions that are in place. But a lot will happen between now and when this plan eventually becomes fully funded. So on the next page, I'm going to go through the GASB results at all. Just one page, summary of GASB 67, which will be in the financial statement. Liabilities are a little bit different because you have to treat the drop participant differently in GASB versus in the valuation. That's a GASB standard we have to mention. But the GASB, the plan fiduciary net position, the net pension liability increased from $2.46 billion to $2.67. Percentage of the total liability, it decreased from 45.36 to 43.49. And these numbers do include all the assumption changes from the experience study.
The increase in liability, is that the new liabilities being accrued each year or in excess of what we're paying down through our benefit payments of almost $250 million a year?
Well, yeah, that would impact the net position. The total liabilities increasing is just due to folks earning more benefits and also the assumption changes. But the assumption changes had the biggest impact on the liability. It would have been around $4.6 billion roughly without the assumption changes. So, yeah, the assumption, and we expect liability to increase each year. Folks earn additional service, pay increases. Obviously, you have folks that will be replaced by lower paid folks, but in general, we expect an increase in the liability each year. So the next page, or the next two pages are the supplemental plan. I don't know if you wanted to go through that or not.
Jeff, why don't you just give them the highlights of the supplemental plan? Because, we don't spend a lot of time talking about that, but it is important, and we did change the funding of how that's funded this year.
Right. That was the main thing I wanted to discuss. Thank you. The supplemental plan, the funding methodology was changed with this evaluation. Previously, the funding policy used an open 10-year amortization period. So each year, the unfunded liability was a 10-year amortization of the unfunded liability was paid. So really, it's never really going to lend itself to being fully paid off. And, compared to the main plan, this is one that you could pay off. So it was changed from a 10-year open period to a closed 20-year period. So the unfunded liability, the supplemental plan, this valuation, will be paid off over a 20-year period, and the period will drop by 1 year each year. So it'll be 20 years this year, 19 years, 18 years, until that chunk of the unfunded liability is paid off. Now, beginning next year, the future gains and losses, each year's gains and loss will be paid off over a closed 10-year period. So you always have amortization basis, and your report will look a little bit different with the amortization basis included. And this is not unusual. A lot of plans have amortization basis. The reason that is if you had just a closed period for retire unfunded liability, and some plans have that in a single base approach, but they just have one closed period. So all the unfunded liability this year would be $20 million, all the unfunded liability next year would be $19 million, and so forth. And that's doable. For most plans, it gets prohibitively expensive when you get down around under 15 years or around 10 years to go because you're paying off the unfunded over a short period each year. So one of the good things about public sector plans is you have some freedom to use to work with an amortization methodology, come up with a funding policy that works best for you. And this is still good. Both plans have periods that are greater than 20 years when they set up new bases. So you have one 20-year base, and each year ongoing will be 10 years. So I think that's a pretty solid approach. that'll lead to this being paid off in the future. So the total recommended contribution drops from $1.97 million to $1.86 million. The assets increase, they decrease from $18.3 million to $17.3 million. Funded ratio drop. Let me check. I think I misstated myself. No, all right, I'm right. I'm sorry. I thought I got the increase, the 197 and 186 switch, but no, it's correct as it's shown there. The funding ratio drop. This plan is a little more volatile because of the nature of the plan. There's going to be some big changes from year to year for the funding percentage, and you see there's a big drop in the funding percentage, 57.6 to 48.3. Now that's bigger than we expect, but there were assumption changes. And with the excess benefits paid to the excess plan or pay over a certain amount, benefits over a certain level getting to, that's having big swings here and last with the funded status and the liabilities. So this is going to jump around a little bit. You can see the liabilities of GASB increased by $5 million. It's going to jump around in this plan more than you would expect or you'd like. The numbers are relatively small compared to the other plan, but hopefully it'll stabilize the excess plan portion in this once we can figure out a better way to project that going forward. I don't know if it's can or not. It's going to change a lot in the last 2 years. But anyways, this is a supplemental plan. The funding ratio did drop. Even though it dropped, the recommended contribution increased a little bit as well.
Who are the participants?
Go ahead.
This is Michael Brown. I was just asking, who are the participants in the supplemental plan?
They are. Yeah, I always have to look this up. Say it correctly.
So what they are, it's basically the portion of a member's benefit that where their pay is above the civil service rank. So as long as you were hired in as a, you know, police officer or firefighter, worked your way through, you will receive, the majority of your benefit from the regular plan. But once you get promoted to basically a chief level and you're above the civil service rank, that portion of your pay is actually paid out of supplemental plan. So it's not that they're getting another benefit, but it is that their entire compensation is being considered in their benefits, so they're not losing out. There is
gotcha.
Situations where you might hire a chief from outside the department that doesn't have any regular benefit because they were never a civil service rank in Dallas, and then their full benefit would be paid out of there. But it really is just really to take into consideration their entire benefit is what this plan does.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey,
and
Mike.
One of the things I wanted to say to add to what Jeff was saying is this plan will bounce around a lot. I expect to see a big change in it next year. But one of the things that we did do when we adopted the funding policy change with the city's agreement is they have agreed to pay the excess plan in addition to the actuarially determined contribution, where in the past it was subtracted from that. So that will help mitigate that piece of the jumping around a little bit.
Hey, Mike, this is Ken Haven. Let me jump in here real quick on the police department side. If you want a quick view of it, it's basically the rank of major and above that are in the supplemental plan, provided they weren't in drop prior to getting promoted to major. And I don't know what it is on the fire department side. I think Armando can jump in on that.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. On the fire department side, it's deputy chief and above.
Okay.
Okay, so that's our presentation. We're available for any questions. I said, I know the evaluations have a lot of information aren't included in the presentation material here because the evaluation is pretty long, but if there's any other questions or anything we didn't touch, we'd be happy to answer.
So if you, after you have a chance to ask Caitlin and Jeff any questions. I do have an 8-slide presentation that kind of summarizes the information they said, just because it's complicated and just another way to look at it, that I'd like to do. And then just remind everybody that when we get to the regular meeting, that's where we'll make the motion to adopt the regular evaluation, and then we get the supplemental meeting, we'll make that motion there. But before I talk to my presentation, are there any questions for Jeff or Caitlin at this time? Okay. I'll go ahead with mine, and whatever I say, Caitlin and Jeff, feel free to correct, and maybe whatever I say will spawn questions. So my presentation starts on page 93, if you can go to that. Thank you. Actually, I guess the first slide is 94. This is just basically I took the information that Siegel has. I appreciate their willingness to provide it to me so I can kind of slice it and dice it in a way that I guess speaks to me. So what I first wanted to do is say, well, what happened to what we thought would happen last year when we had this presentation in 2019 to what actually happened? Because these numbers just change wildly every year. So I wanted to say, what did we think was going to happen in 2019? What actually happened? And that's what is on slide 94. And you can see that we the actual ending net position is $39 million more than was projected in the prior year valuation. And all categories were positive. Investment income and contributions were both more than projected in the prior year valuation. Benefit payments and administrative expenses were both less. So all of that contributed positively to where we thought we would be at the end of 2019. So if that's all that happened, things would be great. Unfortunately, that's not all that happened. The next slide, if you can go to 95, John, is the bridge chart that you're familiar with that Brenda will actually go over with the quarterly financial reports. But what I've done with this is basically take the same information from the prior page, lay it out in the format that you're used to seeing. So we started the year with $2.041 billion as net position. We added investment gains of $124 million. And this was actually, yes. And then we added contributions of $208 million, paid out benefit payments of $309 million, and then we had admin expenses of roughly $6.5 million to end with a net position of $2.057 billion. You can see here with the numbers that are kind of in the little, I guess, a yellow area, we have a sizable net outflow of benefits, where our benefits are $108 million more than the contributions that we bring in every year. So that's something that impacts all of our decision-making related to investments and really everything that we do. On the next slide, I took the information that Jeff had that they used to come up with the full funding year and the market value of assets and the actuarial accrued liability, and I put it into this graph. And you're used to seeing this. You've seen this chart many times. But what I wanted to point out to you is the scale on the bottom used to go from 2019 to 2057. Now it goes from 2020 to 2074. That's quite a big difference. If you look about a third of the way from the right, and I these go by every 2 years, but between about a third of the way, between 2056 and 2058 would have been where this chart ended last year. And if you know, have your eye go up to where that gray line is last year when you saw this, that point that I just pointed you to, we would have been 100% funded, and now we're 60% funded. So although 2019 was exactly what we thought, or actually a little bit better, the valuation is dramatically less positive because of the changes that Jeff talked about. And those changes, some of them was from the experience study, but again, that was minor. But the big changes he mentioned, and I just want to talk to that again, is really the assumption of the investment return for 2020. We're now projecting that we will have a net loss of 6%, where when we did the valuation last year, it was a gain of 5.75%. And we've said consistently that that early losses in this plan had a big impact on this. And you can see that's what we're seeing here. That's what's extending this time and lowering the assumed rate of return. Yes.
Question. And this valuation is January 1st, 20. Why are we reflecting investment losses in 2020? Those were subsequent to the valuation date.
So what I go ahead, Jeff.
I'm sorry, Kelly. To determine the year projected full funding, the negative 6% or the 5.75%, that doesn't impact the liabilities or assets in the valuation, but it does impact the year you're projected to be fully funded.
Right, and it impacts all of those little that my funding swoop chart that's on page 96 there. So that's impacting that. So it doesn't impact where we are in the percentage, but it impacts the go forward. You know, if we lose 6% in 2020, then that's the base that we start at for 2021 and 2022 and so on. That's
okay.
Okay. On slide 97, I guess it is, this is the chart that you've seen before. Again, it looks very similar until you look kind of at the scale over on the left. Instead of this has been elongated up to the year 2074 from 2057. So we spend a lot more time under 50% funded than we did before, so we're spending a lot more time in that riskier level. The next page, I wanted to just show the difference between the net benefit outflows and the contribution inflows under the hiring plan that we talked about a little bit ago, and if we use just the growth rate assumption. And the blue bars on this chart are the hiring plan, and you can see that it isn't until about 2045 where contributions and benefit payments offset each other. But if we are not able to achieve the contributions based at the hiring plan level and we're more at the growth rate level, we won't be to the kind of equilibrium point until 2052. So that's the impact there that Jeff was talking about earlier. And the next slide is this is the one that I think Brenda said in an email when I sent it to them to review was, well, that slide's kind of a gut check, which I think is a good description of this slide, really. So what this shows is the funding percentages based on the numbers that are used to prepare the valuation that Jeff and Caitlin provided. And I compared the 1/1/19 valuation with this new valuation for both the hiring plan and the payroll projected with the 2.5% growth. The blue numbers are based on the hiring plan, and the orange numbers the orange lines are based on the 2.5% growth rate. So if we look at the blue line, the solid line is the based on the current valuation and the hiring plan. So you can see that goes out to 2074. And it's quite a bit lower than the dotted blue line, which was the same hiring plan assumptions that we saw in the valuation before. So I think this graphically really shows the downward shift from this valuation. And, again, that's primarily related to our current estimates of basically mostly our private assets and the impact it's having on the plan. The orange lines are just low, but it's the same thing. The dotted line is 2019, and the solid line is the new valuation. So those are low, and they go out further. Are there any questions on this slide? I think this is an important slide.
Hey, Kelly, it's Nick. The negative 6% projection, how much of that is private assets? Are you making an estimate of write-downs? Are those write-downs that the individual third parties have already marked their assets at? Give us some color on that.
Kent, do you want to talk about that? And I did actually have Kent relook at these estimates actually earlier this week just to make sure we still feel comfortable with the assumption because it has such a big thing. But, Nick, Kent, will you respond to the next question?
Yes. So the first thing I want to mention is that we talked last year about the HUP write-up and our expectation that that would come back to haunt us in the future. And so that's a big part of, you know, $100 million on a $2 billion plan is 5%. And we saw a little bit of a correction in the December 31st numbers from HUP Energy, where it went from, I think, 187 down to 150 or in change. But when we got into the first quarter, we had already kind of been projecting with those staff estimates that it would come down, and it did. And so that's, you know, that's the biggest part of it. We have also included in our estimate an expectation that real estate will probably come down about 25%, and so that's the rest of it. We've seen on these staff estimates of you know, stress values that they are generally coming in, you know, kind of in line with our estimates. And the last thing I'll say is when we looked at this early on, we kind of more like mid-year, it was a minus, or actually it was even back in October was more like a minus 9%, and we tweaked that a little bit, you know, because I just felt like, I'm sorry, it was earlier in the year was minus 9% and felt like it was going to be too egregious, not egregious, but just too severe, and so we tweaked that a little bit. And when I looked at it yesterday, it still looked about, it's going to be about, right at about minus 6%. Now, that does include what's currently kind of $111 million of private market expectations for valuation adjustments by the end of the year. Back to you, Kelly.
So wait a second, Ken. I just, quick question. So you're basically saying there's still some downside to that number?
No, I'm saying that the downside is we have included in the actuarial return expectation for 2020 is additional downside from what is our current reports, because remember we have real estate assets out there that have not yet been appraised in 2020. And so generally as appraisals are coming in and what we're hearing from our managers and from the market is that, you know, real estate is down about 25% for the kind of things we hold. And so we expect when 2020 is said and done, those corrections will come in and turn into actual value reductions.
And so I guess what I'm just alluding to is that that's just the private assets. But I'm saying, like, let's say, for example, going into the close of this year, if we have another shock or dislocation on the public side or the public assets, that can contribute to a bigger downside number. I mean, hypothetically.
Yeah, that's correct. But we're not making any market prognostications. Of, you know, we're just assuming that it's the market is flat. You know, for the last 2 or 3 months of the year. I shouldn't say we're not making any kind of projection on the market. So it's just there's no. So yeah, we don't project any market change. And this is, I guess, the last thing I'll add is this is part of a, you know, we do for this ramp period, which is about 5 years. What we do is we for all the years after 2020, we look at what we go back to Ryan's private market asset projections, and then we project what we expect to get from our asset allocation each year based on Makita's capital market assumptions, and then assuming that our legacy assets get zero in return. And so that's why the ramp comes up, or the return goes up a little bit each year. 2020 was different because of kind of the dislocations in the market this year.
Hey, Bill and Kelly, it's just kind of a broader comment on all of this. I think we've made tremendous progress, you know, since the board came together in terms of unity and kind of understanding the right path for us, you know, with people from different, coming from different places, whether they're a mayoral appointee or from the police and fire, and that's been a great accomplishment. But when you look at the funded ratio under, you know, best case, worst case, middle case, you know, it's going to decline down over the next couple of years, you know, into the 30s, and who knows, maybe a nudge below that. With that, given the 2023, I think, sort of relook per the legislation, I think we have a real communication issue, and we need to get ahead of it, and we need to come up with a plan for how when scrutiny from the public does come our way, which I think for sure it will, given this data, that we respond in a very unified, common sense and intelligent way, because we all know the game plan here, but I think we're going to have a real struggle communicating it if we're not well prepared.
No, I think you're right, Nick, and we've talked about that. I think we do need to get something together, and even with this report, I think we need to communicate exactly why the funding ratio declines and why it's going to likely decline for the next X number of years, so there are no surprises.
So Bill, would we maybe want staff to come up with a communication plan around these issues that we could all look at and put that as an agenda item for a couple meetings from now?
I think that would be a good idea, yes. Why don't we do that, Kelly? Try to get some okay?
All right, that sounds good. You know, and I think it's important, and I have this on my conclusion, which is the next slide, and I'm not really going to go over it, but, you know, when the bill was passed, we knew that it was a path to solvency, and there was a lot of risk along the way. And we told the legislature that, and they knew that, that really the funding was fragile. And that's why there is that 2024 piece where we get back together and see where the funding is. We could have simply taken our assumed rate of return and projected that for all years. That's actually very most common for most systems. But because our funding is so fragile, that's why we take the extra effort to put in this negative six. We don't want to have this negative six, but I can guarantee you if I would have put 7% in here for the next, you know, for all the periods, this would dramatically look different. But sitting here today, I don't think that is the right thing to do. So as painful as this is, I think having the best estimates is where we need to be. And I agree completely that the more we communicate this information kind of earlier into the city, the better off that we'll all be. So I'm not going to go through all the numbers on the conclusion slide, but basically the one thing I wanted to point out is in the prior year evaluation, we thought that the projected funding level would go down for 12 years before it started to go up. Now that's projected to take 20 years before it starts to go up. And we will be below 30% for 11 years and below 40% for 28 years. And neither of those, of course, are good places to be. So I know Bill is working with the city to try to get a group together, but I think we're doing what we need to do here and have a lot of work to do going forward. Is there any questions?
This is Mark Malvo. Would it be of any benefit for us to have some form of, obviously we're getting this type of presentation, but would there be any benefit to have some form of written summary of where we are that actually could be used as a template for how we communicate with the public? I'm also concerned about this being when the public sees this and not knowing the history, they could get kind of out of control.
Yeah, I think it would be a good idea to come up with a way to explain this information where it's understandable. I do struggle with how to do that, which is actually one of the reasons I prepare this kind of secondary slide to the Siegel one is that theirs is so good in detail with so much information in it. I try to just kind of highlight a couple of things. But, Mark, as I'm coming up with this communication plan, I will work on, you know, how we can maybe put something together to help tell the story.
Okay.
Hey, everybody, this is Alan Vaught. I joined a few minutes ago. Sorry, I'm late. Had an emergency this morning, so I'm here now.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
Kelly, do you want to wrap up, Kelly, on your portion?
Well, before you do that, please, I just want to understand what is happening in 2024 again, as you would reiterate, that we can't do sooner. My issue, I mean, I'm just restating the obvious, the dismal outlook here, which was prior to 2020, Makeda, everybody involved, had basically said that this was priced for perfection, okay? We hit 2020. That really, really rattled those projections, and now we're seeing the impact of that. Any additional impact, negative impact, concerns, and it's really, as everyone says, it's important now, today, not 2024, and that's my bigger concern. So if you could explain what we're going back to the legislature, is that what that's happening?
So, Tina, there's no reason we can't do something before 2024. I just want to mention that. The legislation specifically says, and this is off the top of my head, I'm not reading from it, but no later than certain date, there's key dates in 2024 where an independent actuary will be basically recommended by the PRB, hired by the system. They'll do an analysis, and then depending on that analysis, legislation would come out of that if we can't work something out with the city. But likely, even if we do have an agreed upon what we need to do, legislation will be required in 2025. But there's no reason that this process can't start sooner. The blessing, I guess, that we have is we do have the floor on the contributions, and we have that extra $13 million that comes in annually. That's helpful, and that goes through 2024. But we can start earlier.
And that analysis has to the city has to be part of that.
The city does not specifically have to be part of it, and it's laid out, but any solution is going to have to be, you know, involved. The city's going to have to be involved with any solution. The analysis is done by an independent actuary that I believe the board hires. The board hires, but I think the PRB selects the actuary.
Let me just add, Kelly, okay, that I've had conversations with the mayor. He recognizes that we shouldn't be waiting till 2024, that we need to be looking at ways to improve the funding status of the plan, which only can come about from a large infusion of contributions above and beyond what's in these plans. And he's looking at that issue now and trying to figure out, is there what could be done between now and 2021, 22 to try to do that. So it's not like we're ignoring it, nor is he ignoring it. There's some work being done, some analysis being done about what alternatives are available to improve the funding with a large infusion. So just everybody should know that. So it's not being ignored. What comes of that, I don't know, but it's being looked at and analyzed.
Bill, I have one question for that. One last question, and I'll just let it go. We can move on. But in those discussions, Is the discussion at all discussed of increasing the contributions for members? Because that there's no meat on that bone.
I don't know. The conversations today are no changes in benefits, no changes in member contributions. It's how do you find a way to make a large contribution. So yes. No, there is not that discussion. I think we all recognize that's an impossible. That's not something that can be done at this stage.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Bill. Bill.
Yes.
Real quick, in your discussions with the mayor, did he give you like a timetable on how long this analysis would take, or say, hey, check back with me in March, or is there any follow-up?
Yeah, no, he's working on that, and I think it's looking at about next fall to have some kind of an idea of what we can do. So it's about a year process to review that, I think.
But Bill, I would add, and this is, you know, kind of ad hoc observations, when you and I testified in front of that pension committee of this of the state house, I think it was.
Yes.
You know, what we heard from a couple people was, hey, we fixed this thing, and are you saying, you know, we didn't fix it? And there was a little bit of that, and I've had one or two conversations with state reps just over the last year or two, and I will say that I think their attitude is that they think we fixed this thing. And so that's why when I'm talking about a communication plan, I think we'll have a lot of heavy work to do with the state legislature.
And I mean, I think part of the communication plan has to be meeting with those folks and letting them know what the facts are so that there's no surprises when the city comes back in 2023 or whatever, 2022, whatever, and sort of says this is what we need to do.
And Bill, this is Armando. To that point, we're coming up on a legislative session in 2021. And again, the next point, coming up with that communication plan, we need to have it sooner rather than later so that our lobbyists can go down there and start advocating on our behalf.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't think we're going to have a solution, but I do think that having a communication and start lobbying and letting people know that something needs to be done is a good idea. So let's let Kelly come up with this communication plan, include in that that we got to address not only the public and the members, but also the legislature and the city people so that they're all on board as to what the facts are. Okay, Kelly, anything else you want to add?
I have nothing else on this item, and I think the only other item that we have under the required public meeting would be public comment.
Yes, I was going to get to that. Okay, John, what is it, pound six if somebody wants to talk?
And it's 5-star on their phone.
5-star, and then let me know how many people we are so we can figure out time because time is starting to become a premium.
There's 9 people from the public, and we do have one.
We have one. Okay, why don't we allow that person to speak then?
Go ahead.
Hello?
This is Vinay Schumann from the City of Dallas. I was curious about, at the beginning of the meeting, I wasn't able to listen to the number of years to fund, and you were basically stating that there was a 2020 that there would be a negative 6% rate of return, and that was going to be different from what was expected. What was the expected actual rate of return, and how much was that going to increase the years to fund, specifically because that was the most significant change that Kelly talked about?
Jeff, you answered that. Didn't you say there was an 11-year increase to fund based on that assumption?
Yes. The change from 5.75 to -6 for 2020 had an 11-year impact on years to fund.
Okay, thank you. That answers my question.
Okay, there is nobody else. Why don't we go ahead and get a motion to adjourn the public meeting? I'll move it. Does somebody want to second that?
Armando, I'll second it.
Okay, Armando. Okay. Well, anybody opposed to that? Okay. We are adjourning that meeting. So, John, what do you tell me when we're ready to reconvene the regular meeting?
Yeah, you're good to go.
Okay. Let's go to trying to get to where the regular meeting agenda. System is making me put in another password.
It's page 102, Bill, when you get to it.
Okay. Give me 1 second. 102. Okay. Okay, can you get to the slide, John, with the names of the recently deceased officers and firefighters? Okay, let's just take a moment of silence for those retired police and firefighters who have passed away since September 27th. Okay, thank you. Next is the approval of the minutes that is on, starts at page 107. Does anybody have any comments or corrections they would like us to make? Hearing none, somebody want a motion approval?
Yes, Ken, I'll move approval.
Thank you, Ken. Second, somebody second?
I'll second.
Okay, was that Armando or was that Gilbert? I couldn't tell.
Well, Gilbert did, but...
Okay.
Yeah, I did, too.
Okay, anybody opposed? No? Okay, it carries. So next, we're going to go to the consent agenda. Is there anything... There was something new in there, I thought. Look, I'm getting to it, but Kelly, do you want to comment on anything that's not normal or unusual?
There's really nothing that is unusual, but maybe more infrequent, where we do have this time military leave contributions that are being purchased, a spouse who's buying a benefit after they retired, and someone who's paying for withdrawn contributions. So those are not unusual, but they are infrequent. But there's nothing.
Yeah, that was my question. Is what is the payment of a previously withdrawn contribution?
So typically that is, it's one of two things. The member either terminated their employment with the city and took a refund of contributions, or they got a divorce and their spouse took a refund. In both cases, they can pay those contributions back with interest if they want to buy the time back.
Okay. Okay, then I'll move that we approve the consent agenda. Do we have a second?
Alan, second.
You second.
Okay, thank you, Alan. Anybody opposed? Okay, it's unanimous, then it carries. Okay, again, John, do you want to give instructions? We're at the public comment period on the agenda. Does anybody want to make any public comments as part of the regular meeting? Why don't you give them the instructions, John, and see if we have anybody.
Yes, if you'll press 5-star on your phone, and we do have a question.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Bill. This is Ken Sprecher. I'm a retiree, and I have a couple of comments and a couple of questions I was hoping you could help me with.
Okay.
I'd first, just on what's been discussed so far this morning, I'd just like to reiterate that I think Nick's idea of having a communication plan prior to 2023 is spot on, and we need to do that. And I want to agree with Kelly for using realistic estimates in all of this. I think it's just a better way to go than use numbers that aren't going to pan out later on. But what I had intended to just bring up today with the board or just comment on. I had a couple of questions also, and I don't mean to be piling on in terms of the private assets, but regarding item 14 on today's agenda, which is the Lone Star investment, can you tell me if this $16 million funding, will that apply to more than one fund?
I mean, that's an ongoing negotiation that we're still having, and we don't have an agreement with them, but it would apply to more than one fund. I think it was three different funds that it would apply to, but it has not been resolved, not fully endorsed or authorized by Keller or myself for the motion. So that's still an open item that will come back to the board probably in the next month or so for final resolution.
Okay, thanks. And related to that, I understand what you said, that you're not firm on a dollar amount, but any funding would materially affect the private asset cash flow projection?
I don't think there'll be a material impact, but we would only do it if we're senior secured debt that we're highly assured of getting our money back plus a good return before any other. Yeah.
All right. Well, I appreciate answering those questions. And just a final comment about this. Over the years, I've seen Arthur Hollingsworth sit in our boardroom and ask for extension after extension, and in effect tell us when his ship comes in, we'll all be flush. Of course, this never happened. And I'd remind the board, this is also the same person who was named in a Medicaid scam a few years ago in federal court that resulted in a $1 million settlement. So forgive me if I don't have a lot of confidence in the general partner's abilities or character. It seems like there should have been some type of morals clause in our contract, the Lone Star, that protects investors from general or managing partners from engaging in unlawful behavior. But that's water under the bridge now. Thank you for your time and good luck.
It's a partnership we inherited from before this board was impaneled in 2000.
I understand exactly, Bill, and I know it's been a burr under our saddle for years. I'm just getting that off my chest, and I appreciate you listening.
Okay, thank you. John, anyone else?
No, I don't see anybody else.
Okay, so then the first item on our agenda was the actuarial evaluation, which Jeff and Caitlin have already done, so we will incorporate that by reference. We do need a motion to approve the issuance of the evaluation report, subject to final review by the auditors and review and approval by the executive director. Will somebody make that motion?
I'll make the motion, Nick.
Thank you, Nick. Second it, somebody?
I'll second Gilbert.
Thanks, Gilbert. Anybody opposed? Okay, it passes. We've got that approved. Brenda, you're going to give us an update on the financial audit?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Bill. Good morning, everyone. As I reported last month, we received the final audited financial statements for our investments in October. With that information, I was able to complete our financial statements and send them to the actuary, and this morning you saw the actuary report from Siegel. With the completion of the actuary report, we are now working on completing the audited financial statements and the CAFR, and we expect to have them finished in the next few weeks and plan to present them to the board in December. One last thing to add is during this time, I have continued to update both the PRB and the GFOA about the status of our audit, and we have received waivers or extensions as needed. Are there any questions about the status of the audit?
Hey, Brenda, this is Kelly. I don't have any questions about the status of the audit, but taking your pause to let Jeff and Caitlin know if they haven't already dropped off that they're free to do that, and thank you.
All right, I appreciate that. I might listen to a little bit of the financial information if that's all right, and then just drop off in a little while.
Okay, I just want to make sure that you knew that we were done. Sorry to interrupt, Brenda.
No problem. Thank you.
No worries.
And Brenda, we have an audit committee meeting scheduled sometime in early December as well, right?
Right. I believe it's on Wednesday, December the 9th. That would be the day before the December board meeting.
Okay. So that would be Tina and Armando and myself will conduct that meeting.
Thank you. Looking forward to getting this audit completed and behind us.
Yeah. Okay, you got the next item as well, Brenda. Go ahead.
Yes. So this is the second reading and discussion of the 2021 proposed budget. So the first reading of the budget was last month at the October board meeting. Since then, on October 26th, I presented the budget to the City of Dallas's Government Performance and Financial Management Committee. The committee did not have any comments or suggestions about the budget to provide to the board. We also have posted the budget to our website for member review, and there have been no changes in the budget since the October board meeting. So, John, if you'll go up one page, please. So just to briefly review, the total budget for 2021 is $23.62 million. That's compared to $23.58 million for the 2020 budget. So we're up just slightly at $39,000 or 0.2%. And when you compare that to the 2020 budget, the 2020 projected actual of 22.5, that's up 1.6 or 5.2. Again, I want to mention that increase is primarily due to COVID-19 cancellations, deferrals, or delays during 2020. Are there any questions about the 2021 proposed budget?
Okay, hearing none, can we get a motion to approve the budget?
So moved. It's Gilbert.
Gilbert, thank you. Have a second?
Alan, second.
Alan, second. Thank you. Anybody opposed? Okay, it is approved then. Okay, Brenda, you're still on. You've got the financial report now.
Yes. Okay, so I want to do a brief review of the third quarter financials for 2020. John, if you'll go to the next page, please. I want to start with the bridge chart. This is the same format that you saw earlier that Kelly was going over. So we'll start with the 12/31 net position. Then we adjust for investment, benefit and operations transactions, and then we arrive at the 9/30/2020 net position. So we began the year with a net position of $2.075 billion. We had investment-related transactions of $2.76 million, or they were decreased. The net position was decreased by that. And we had benefits and operations-related transactions that decreased the net position by $80.6 million, and our 9/30/2020 net position is $1.992 billion, down about $83 million since 12/31. John, will you move to the next page, please? So this is our combined statement of fiduciary net position. I'll just briefly, again, discuss some of the highlights. Total investment at 9/30 were $1.9 billion compared to $1.97 billion at 12/31/19, or a decrease of $66 million. The overall decline in the investment value was led by fixed income and real assets. If we take a look at fixed income, there were withdrawals from IR&M of $56 million. Loomis sales, we did a withdrawal of $14.8 million that we rebalanced to cash. We redeployed the Loomis sales SR liquidated that to Pacific Asset Management. And then we made some purchases in Vanguard during the year. They've since been liquidated, and they were used to fund Longfellow during this year. And as we look at real assets, there were distributions from AEW of $17 million so far this year and from Museum Tower of $6.8 million. And along with some valuation declines, this contributed to the reduction in real assets. As we move about halfway down the page to cash and cash equivalents, they've decreased about $21 million since December 31st. There were two portfolio rebalancings during the first quarter that used $17 million in cash. And again, as we've already talked about, the pension contribution benefit shortfall uses cash, and that's been about $76 million year-to-date. These outflows have been partially offset by distributions and income from assets during the year. As we move a little further down the page, under payables, accounts payable and other accrued liabilities have declined about $834,000 since 12/31. The primary leader in that decline is the decrease in the accrual for fund management fees. It's been about $1 million at the end of the year. There are some performance fees that are only billed at the end of the year, and so that causes the year-end accrual to be higher. Again, accrued liabilities are down some. That's offset by AP being up a little bit. Uncompensated absences accrual is up about $146,000, and we've talked about that some because of the leave accruals related to COVID. Let's go ahead and go to the next page, John. This is
Brenda,
the changes.
I'm sorry, can I interrupt really quickly? I apologize if you went over it and I did not hear it. But what are forward currency contracts? How are they? I mean, what is that?
So, John, will you go back one page, please?
I apologize.
No, no problem at all. So that's a lot of the currency differences between in the foreign, in the funds that we have. They run through this forward currency line. We put the currency difference there.
This is Kent. There are some modest currency hedging both in the equity portfolio and also in the global bond portfolio. That's in there.
That the fund does outside the actual fund, that the actual pension system does outside the fund?
No, isn't it the managers that do that?
Yeah. It's the managers.
Okay, thanks.
Typically, in an international program, the managers have a discretion if they like a stock or a bond in a country, but they don't like the currency. They can trade sell the currency back to dollars or pounds or euros, etc. And I think what this reflects is either the gain or loss from transactions unrealized at this point in time. That's the way I read it.
Yes, thank you, Bill.
That answer you, Tina?
John. Thank you. Yeah, it does. I'm aware of how these forwards work. I just wanted to know how they were embedded in the whole process.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you. So now we're looking at the changes in fiduciary net position. First, we'll look at contributions. City contributions have increased when we compare to a year ago. So this comparison is year over year as opposed to 12/31. We're up a little over $5 million as compared to September 30th, 2019. The increase in the city contributions is primarily due to the floor increase from $5.571 million per pay period to $5.724 million per pay period. And the impact of the increase in the floor is about $3 million. As we look at member contributions, so regular member contributions increased about $4.2 million. That's related to increased salaries and a partial year increase in employee levels. At 6/30, we were up 235 in employee count when you compare to last year. But when we get to 9/30, we are now down 41 when we compare to last year. And I know Kelly will have some more information on this when she does her contribution presentation. So offsetting some of the regular member contributions, pension buybacks were up 87, but declines in drop contribution, that's the big decline, $610,000, which, as Jeff mentioned, fewer people joining drop, so we're seeing fewer contributions into the drop account. As we move down into investments and we look at the net appreciation and depreciation, again, this is primarily driven by changes in the market, the real asset, and the fixed income market. As we move down to about the bottom third, where we see deductions, benefits paid to members, service pensions increased by $6.1 million as compared to last year. Survivor benefits increased by $1.5 million. These were partially offset by declines in disability payments of about $219,000. And again, these new service retirements or the increased service retirement is driven by higher monthly benefits and the number of benefits being paid to members. As we move down to expenses, look at legal expenses, declines in the Deegan and editing case legal expenses. Those are offset by increase for fees in other cases like the actuary cases and the USERRA case. As we look at staff expenses, staff salaries, benefits, increase year over year due to the filling of an open position. And again, this staff vacation where employees continue to earn but have not taken vacation in 2020. And finally, I want to look at just professional and administrative expenses up $54,000. And that's generally related to either new expenses or the timing of expenses so far this year. Any questions? Hello?
Yeah, we don't need to do anything further, so there are no questions. We'll just move on to Kelly. You've got three or four items here on our agenda.
I do. I have the next two items. Oh, go ahead, Brenda. Sorry.
No. There's the one other benefit chart that shows just graphically the shortfall between the benefit contributions and the benefit payments. Last three quarters are showing, they're staying steady about 79 to 80 million contributions, about 54 to 55. So the average shortfall was about the average monthly shortfall was about $8.2 million. So, over to you, Kelly.
Okay. So I have the next several items, but my John, my Zoom screen is black. Is that just me?
No, I've got
everybody. I've lost my connection to the internet here. I'm working on getting.
Okay.
Okay.
Make better. I thought that was just me.
Oh, okay. I thought it was me too. So I know you've all seen the contribution report, and I can wait to try to tell John brings it up or continue. It's your choice. Some of you might be working off a PDF anyway.
Well, why don't you cover the next item, which is more oral anyway, and then if it's not back up, then you can do it orally.
Or Kelly, just reference the page on the diligence if I have it up.
It's coming back. It's back.
Okay, on page 247 is the contribution report, and this is the report based on the September data. There were three pay periods in this in September that began in September. So what you're seeing on this report is that the contributions based on actual comp pay for the month of September were actually very close to the floor, just under the floor by about $7,000. So they're 100% of the floor, basically, and 109% of the hiring plan. On the year-to-date basis, the contributions based on actual comp pay have been 97% of the floor and 106% of the hiring plan. And the last line in that upper box shows the inception to date. We're at 91% of the floor. So the floor has contributed $38.7 million to the plan, and we're at 100% of the hiring plan. So that is good. I mean, that recognizes the city has made great strides in their pay and their hiring. The next page I wanted to go to, since you're familiar with this report, is the page number 250. And that just shows the hiring. The very bottom line on September and that little bottom chart shows that for the month we are 62 members behind the hiring plan. They estimated 5,063. They were at 5,001. Fire is over their number by 34, and police is down by 96. So all in all, things are looking good on the contribution side. Are there any questions about this report? Okay. If it's okay with you, Bill, I'll go on to the next item.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. On the COVID issue, Brenda brought this up a couple of times in her review of both the budget and the financial report, that we're seeing an increase in the liability that we're recording because staff hasn't been taking as much of their earned leaves because of COVID. And so we put this on here to give the board an update because it's come up in a couple of different meetings. And what I wanted to emphasize here is no staff member is getting more time than they normally would have. So this isn't extra pay or extra time in any way. It's just that they haven't been taking the time that they normally would at the normal pace. So we've allowed them to exceed the maximum. And what we're talking about here as of today, it's about 10 and a half weeks of time for the entire staff group. It impacts really 9 people. We're only talking about 10 and a half weeks of total time for all of the staff. And what we are going to do is allow the staff until the end of 2021 just to use that, or they'll lose that time. A lot of that time actually I think will be used up this year in 2020 in November and December, because staff does not accrue more time in November and December just the way our accruals work, and they typically use a lot of time around the holidays. So I think at this point, although because our staff size is so small, the numbers keep popping up and we keep talking about it, but we do have a plan to have staff use this time in a relatively decent pace that won't cause disruption to services. Are there any questions or concerns about this?
I thought this was always at your discretion.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
I said I thought that this was already, maybe I was wrong, but it was already established that it would be at your discretion on how to handle
this. Yes. Yeah, and this is what we've done, and I just was updating the board of where we are and kind of where we need to go. So I don't need a motion on it, but I wanted to let you know because it is showing up a little bit in the numbers, And it's really because our numbers are so small. We're talking about, 10 weeks of time here. So it's not a huge amount, but they do show up. So I don't need a motion. I'm just more informational.
Kristen, I'm on the board meeting call right now. Can I call you back later after the board meeting's over? Thank you, Mike.
Okay, so the next item, if there's no questions on the COVID piece, is the required training manual delivery, and that is John's on flight 252. But I'm going to ask John to go out of this and go into diligence and share his screen so you can kind of see where this training manual is. And it's going to take him just a couple of minutes to get there. But while he's doing that, I will tell you why we're doing this. One of the provisions that was added to the legislation in 2017, in addition to the required public meeting that you did earlier, is this requirement that on an annual basis the executive director deliver this manual to the board. And it's also required that you acknowledge that you receive the manual. When we began doing this, the board decided that we would do this electronically. So I wanted to show you where this is, and that will constitute delivery. So John has pulled up his screen on Diligent, which should look familiar to you. If you use the iPad, the button might be in a little different place, but the information is still the same. So if you go to the Resource Center, John, which is right there where he's doing a little circle, thank you, and you click on the Resource Center, you'll see the second item after the call-in instructions is the board training manual in all caps there. You can click on that. And these three, six, eight or so folders are the specific items in the bill that we are required to give you on an annual basis. They are the governing documents. So the first, and I'm not going to have John go through each of these, but everything is here listed for you for your ease of access. Most of all of this stuff is also on our website, but it's all together here. So I'll just briefly talk about what's in here. So the first item is the governing document. So that's 6243A-1 and also the supplemental plan, pension plan. The next item is the budget and other rules, the rulemaking authority and limitations. Some of this, by the way, we had to interpret what did they mean by that, and this is what our interpretation is. So under the rulemaking authority and limitations, we've taken excerpts from relevant materials, such as, what the board's authority is in 6243A-1 and put it under here. We also have the audit under here. Open meetings laws is under the next item, open records, those types of things. There's policies, ethics policies and governance items are under the second to the last one. Other laws include open meeting laws, open record laws, Section 802 of the Government Code. There's all kinds of pieces of information in here for you for ease of access. The last item is kind of a strange one, but it specifically says that we need to include training on alternative investments. So that's why this last item here, Makita provided us with a presentation on alternative investments. It looks a little strange with all the other items. It kind of looks out of place, but that's why it's here. It's specifically called for. So with that, are there any questions about the training manual? Okay, thank you. And so what will happen now is we will update this with the final budget. Basically, I think just changing the title. When we get the new audit, we'll update that with the new audit. But Carol or Melissa will send you an email today with a form for you to sign saying you've received the manual. And if you could send that back, that would be great. We will file it away. We don't have to send it to the PRB or anybody. We just keep it in a file. Okay?
Great.
All right. The next item that I have is the board approval of trustee education and travel. There are no requests this month for anybody to attend any training unless somebody has something today. We have three classes listed. The first class that's on here actually has already passed. It was a webinar. We kept it on the list because it actually occurred between the time we posted and today's meeting, in case you happen to see it and wanted to attend it. But if there's at this point, I don't have any requests for education or travel, so unless anybody has anything, I don't need a motion for that item either. Okay, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Kelly. We're now at Kent. Your turn to start updating us on a couple of items here.
Thanks, Bill. First is just the portfolio update. John, if you can move forward to slide 257, 257. Okay, so I've just I'm now going to be showing one asset allocations. With the last meeting, we kind of collapsed the book NAV and the adjustments into one slide, so you can see it all here. And in that adjustments column, which is the third column from the left, first in dollars and then in percent of NAV, the total adjustments are now $111 million. That was $226 million previously, and a lot of that had to do with lower adjustments in private equity as the actual values came in. And I mentioned earlier that kind of generally things are coming in line with our projections. And so even though our adjustments, are half as what they were just a month ago, our adjusted NAV was essentially unchanged at $1.777 billion versus $1.772. So just mention that. Down at the bottom, if you look kind of at the second row from the bottom, that's our safety reserve. We're trying to keep 30 months of net cash flow in there, about $9 million a month or $270 million. So we're a little bit high on that at 281. And we're going to talk a little bit about global bonds and high yields. And if we proceed with the recommended action to liquidate the global bonds, the safety reserve will balloon for a little while, and we'll use that money to pay cash flow in the coming months, and we don't expect a lot of private markets, but if we do get them, private market distributions will go into equities. The other things I want to show here, if you look at the investment-grade bonds, kind of in the middle of fixed income there, on the far right, you'll see our variance is about $11 million. And then if you look four rows down, you'll see emerging market debt, which has a four percent allocation, but right now is only at about a percent. And that's by design. We have an asset allocation implementation plan, and that's lower in the priority. But again, with the global bond allocation or discussion, we've suggested kind of topping off investment grade bonds and adding money to emerging market debt to bring that up to a half a position. That's all of my notes on the asset allocation. Next slide, please. So some good progress on investment initiatives over the last month. As always, it's the same kind of top couple of bullets with, working on private market assets, a lot of work on real estate, trying to set things up. I think it's going to be a slow year in rest of 2020 and 2021. We have a couple things that may come in, but still a lot of working on those assets and continued evaluation and engagement on private equity. We had a public comment earlier about one of our private equity funds, and we do spend a lot of time working through those and trying to guide those to their best outcome. Global equity, I talked about this last time, and we are working on a recommendation for the December board where we're projecting to recommend a passive sleeve within the global equity section, just a passive global equity. It's a recommendation from the Investment Advisory Committee. We've previously had fixed income as kind of these global bond and high yield recommendations as a work in process, and those we're going to talk about momentarily. I've also had the IMA reviews on here, and this was something that kind of came out from a couple different places.
having to do with Loomis was carrying a lot of cash, Loomis High Yield, going into 2019, and how are we looking at those guidelines? And so this actually is a pretty big project. We broke it up into kind of checking the provisions of all of our IMAs and then making sure that we know what certifications the managers are supposed to be providing and if they provided them, and then evaluating all the guidelines. And so we have gone through all the IMAs, and Greg, Mike, and Ryan are doing the majority of this work, and identified kind of all those certifications and checked where we have gotten them all. There were a couple that were missing. We're filling those in. We've identified most of the guidelines, and over the next couple of weeks, we'll be comparing those and seeing what changes we might want to make in making those. And then last, as we talked about, we'll have an asset allocation study coming up in 2021. Probably others are hearing this as well. A little bit of background echo, so anyone can go on mute. That will be helpful. Anyone that's not on mute. And next slide, please, John. And just brought up this calendar. So the last 2 years, we've talked about a part of the portfolio at every meeting. We completed this in October. We've gotten some feedback that maybe we're getting a little too deep, and I think maybe we can go through some of this stuff a little bit faster. I'll kind of bring this back up in December, accept additional feedback on that, and we'll plan on doing this again maybe in a little bit more efficient manner in 2021, but I'll ask for your guidance on that in December. Okay, that's it for investment update. Any questions? Okay. And I guess whenever I ask for questions from staff, if I've forgotten something agree, just let me know. Otherwise, we'll move forward. I think the next item is the high yield. Okay. So the background on this, DPFP and Loomis have a long-term relationship. We've been in this full discretion, it's called the full discretion portfolio, since the late 90s. This is an opportunistic portfolio, meaning that the guidelines are relatively loose, and theoretically that allows the manager to bring their maximum skill to bear in the portfolio and maximize returns. And over the long term, that has in fact been the case. Our portfolio has outperformed the high yield composite, the narrower high yield composite, as well as the high yield full discretion composite. However, in 2019, our portfolio suffered a bit due to a position that Loomis had it goes into it in the memo, but heavy cash, and they were heavy in energy, and that ended up not working out. And so we took a look at what do we really want from a higher yield portfolio going forward. Also, Dan Fuss, the legendary fixed income investor, had rotated. He was our portfolio manager on this, and he rotated off the portfolio in April 2019. And so we've gone through a couple of things. One, a lot of work from Loomis and also Mike Yan from our staff in bringing our portfolio in line with their full discretion composite, and Loomis did a great job of that. And then longer term, we were looking at kind of what product do we want going forward. And so as part of that, we looked at potentially, while we had very high conviction in the current portfolio team, I don't want to call them the new portfolio team because they've been managing high yield portfolios at Loomis for decades, but they are new to us. They've done a great job for us. We also wanted to look at were there any other products out there that would be better. And in the end, what we're recommending, and we've talked to both Makita and the Investment Advisory Committee about this, is to stay with Loomis but shift over to a more benchmark aware U.S. high yield product. That's it. So with this, there'll also be a change in the benchmark for the asset class to a U.S. high yield product. So that's pretty much it. Leo, anything that you wanted to add? Leo and Makita were very involved in this discussion. And then I want to ask for staff and Dilbert as well.
Good morning, Kent, and great review. Good morning, trustees.
Not much to add here. It was a year-long process, and there is the benefit also of some fee savings in moving to this strategy. I think we eliminate currency risk. I think it is more aligned with what I would call best practices, or, you know, more common. We reduce a lot of tracking error and uncertainties, and we still retain a solid manager in the space. I think it is a better fit. This went through the IAC, so I think it's been pretty well vetted, and the process was sound and well documented.
Thank you, Leo. And Gilbert's been helpful on this. Gilbert, any comments or perspectives, please?
Thank you. I think most of the things I would call it maintenance, clarification, things of that nature. As it relates to Loomis, I think the key there really was, you know, when you do your asset allocation, you make a commitment to some asset class like high yield. If the manager can then move a great deal of that allocation into cash, in many ways, you are going counter to the asset allocation in the first place. So I think that's one of the reasons for tightening this up. So I think the staff has gotten their hands around it. And that's really all I have, Ken.
Thank you, Gilbert. If there's no further questions, Mr. Chair, I'll send it back to you to act on the recommendation, please.
Well, I think we don't need to make a motion here. We're going to do that when we get to the investment policy statement. You can just cover the global bond allocation there. We do need to get approval. So why don't you cover that, and then we'll get into the investment policy statement.
Okay. All right. Moving on to the global bond allocation. Keep going.
Yes.
There we go. Okay. And so I'll just kind of talk to this. We've got a detailed memo in there. And so I guess the overriding factor here is that, you know, we're all aware of kind of quantitative easing around the world, and that bond yields, you know, both in the U.S. and globally, but more so globally, have collapsed to near nothing or even negative. And we've had conversations in past meetings about, you know, do we have any negative yielding debt in our portfolio? The answer is no. We've got a good global bond manager, Brandywine. They have responded admirably to the challenges of the asset class by continuing to search out and find attractive bonds with attractive real yields. The upshot of that is that the portfolio has more emerging market debt and more corporate debt than it's had in the past, less treasuries. And currency has, which has always been a part of their portfolio practice or their process, has taken on a bigger impact on the overall performance attribution. And so Leo and Makita suggested that we consider whether this was really something that was going to be attractive for DPFP long term. And so, again, while Brandywine has done fine, we just think that this is going to be a very difficult space going forward. And so we're recommending that we liquidate our global bond allocation. Use that money, as I talked about earlier, we'll top off. We're recommending that we top off investment grade bonds, add some money to the emerging market debt to bring it up to half allocation, 2% of their allocation, and then use the rest of the money for cash flow. We're not making a recommendation with regard to changing that allocation right now. We want to do that as part of the broader asset allocation study in 2021. And there's no real pressure because we have such a variance in global equity that we'll have any extra money that happens to come in from private markets. It'll just go right into the public markets equity. So that's the end of my conversation there, and I'll turn it over to Leo and then Gilbert to ask for their input on these.
Thank you, Ken, again. Good morning, everybody. This is a topic that has been discussed since earlier in 2020
We raised the issue as interest rates came down at the onset of the pandemic in the first quarter. And then from that point on, we spent lots of meetings debating what to do here. A bit of a tricky issue because I think staff, Nikita, and others think highly of Brandywine asset manager. It is just that the asset class has lost some of its momentum, if you will, as global yields in developed markets primarily have become negative or very low, as in the case of the States. In addition, the currency impact has become more prevalent, and we need to consider these within the context of DPFP's liquidity position. We still have quite a bit of the portfolio tied up in private assets. Some of that has come back, but a lot still remains unaccounted for, and we're waiting for that distribution to hopefully take place sooner than later. In the meantime, our liquidity position is at a premium, and we need to optimize that. So in our view, there's two main roles for that liquidity piece. One is the defense part. That's what we have with the safety reserve, investment-grade bond allocation. The rate should be offense, trying to catch the returns, and this is kind of a strangle in the middle with some volatility in the currency. So we didn't feel strongly that it merits an allocation, and that's what was the premise for initiating this discussion, which ultimately culminated in agreement by staff, Nikita, and the Investment Advisory Committee on moving on from this asset class. We plan to conduct an asset allocation study as soon as we have new projections, which typically come towards the end of January. So hopefully sometime, maybe by the March meeting, we might be in a position to recommend, after more thorough analysis, where to redeploy, at least on the policy target, this allocation to global bonds, which is 4%. We may have other recommendations as well, but that would be certainly one of those. With that, I'll pause. We have some materials that go over these topics from Brandywine in the report in front of you as well.
Thank you, Leo. John, if you can turn it to page 273, which has the recommendation, and then Gilbert, just appreciate your perspective on this.
Sure. So I don't have too much more to add in the interest of time other than I think we got to just, as we went through earlier where we are, we just got to make the most money we can with our money. And sometimes the best way is to not lose money. And when you think of where rates are and where rates are globally, I just think this is a good move. And a lot of the work has been done to support it. So in the interest of time, that's really all I have to add.
Thank you, Gilbert. And on the page here, we have kind of what we plan to do with that money, as I've talked about already. And one other point I wanted to make here is Gilbert and another member of the Investment Advisory Committee had recommended that we move sooner rather than later to make this transition. We will proceed in that manner. Preliminary discussions with Brandywine, who they've been very helpful, and we think this will probably take 2 to 3 weeks to make this exit, but we'll plan on proceeding that way. So I think we want to make a motion on this.
Gilbert, can I assume you're making the motion on this one?
Yeah, that's right, Mr. Chairman. I'll make the motion. Gilbert's here.
Okay, thank you. I'll second it. It just makes a lot of sense, so I think it makes sense. Any further questions or discussions before we vote? Hearing none, anybody oppose? Nope. Okay, it passes then. We'll thank you guys, a lot of hard work on the investment. But one of the things I think I just mentioned is that we've got a very good vetting process. I mean, Gilbert's very knowledgeable in this area. We've got the... Okay, we've got Makita, we've got staff who does a wonderful job, so I think we can depend and rely on a lot of what they're recommending. With that, we're going to move on to the investment policy statement. I don't know, Kelly or Ken, are you going to walk us through what change we're being asked to make?
I will watch.
Kelly will take that.
John, if you can go to the investment policy starts on page 221, and if you can go, the first change in the policy is actually on page 226, so if you can go to that, that would be great. Okay, so the change that we're proposing is in section BD, in the bottom part of the page, and what we're recommending here in advance of the next item on the agenda is that we increase the composition of the Investment Advisory Committee. It's currently limited to 6 members. 1 or 2 can be current board members, and we're recommending increasing this to 7 members and allowing up to 3 of those members to be current board members. The only legislative restrictions on the formation of the IAC just says there needs to be the majority of outside investment professionals, so more outsiders than current board members, and this would still comply with that. So that's the first recommended change. And
yeah,
the other go ahead.
No, I would just mention we've got 4 outsiders. There's been one of the next item on our agenda. We're going to talk about trying to get a trustee on a independent committee, and to do that and get everybody on with at least that, we're going to nominate a third person to the Investment Advisory Committee. So that's the reason we're going ahead and asking for this at this point. Go ahead, Kelly.
The next item is related to what Kent was talking about, related to Loomis, and it's on page 239. You can go to that. It's in Appendix B of the policy, and that's just a change to the benchmark that we talked about for the high-yield bonds from the Bloomberg Barclays Global High Yield to the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Corporate High Yield. So that's the only other change in the policy based on the Loomis analysis that was discussed earlier. And there will be a more full, in-depth review of the investment policy statement in 2021, where we go through and we look at all the provisions in much more depth, but these are the 2 changes that we're recommending at this time.
Does anybody have questions about either of these? Okay. Can we get a motion to approve these changes then?
So moved. It's Gilbert.
Thank you, Gilbert. Second?
Armando,
thank you. Anybody opposed? Great, thank you. The next item is the board committee membership. As I said, we're trying to rebalance this and get everybody working on a committee. I've talked to most people whose assignments would either be changed or added to. What I'd like to do is nominate, and I'll go through the slate basically, continue to have Gilbert chair the Investment Advisory Committee, and we would add Michael Brown and Ken Habner to that committee. Again, that would make 3 trustees, and we've got 4 outsiders, Bob Jones, Scott Freeman, Rakesh Dayo from SMU, Bill Velasco. So that would be fully staffed committee. On the Personal Service Committee, which reviews annually our outside providers that include Makita, Siegel, and Jackson Walker, to meet with them independently to evaluate how they're doing as well as they're working with staff. I would nominate Nick to chair that. I hope he's still on, but I've talked to him about it already, so he is fine.
I'm on, Bill.
Okay, very good, Nick. Thanks. Then we have, I would add Steve, I know Rob French is already a member. Mark will add, and Alan will add. When I was given people choices of the Audit Committee or the Personal Service Committee, people tend to prefer to be on the Personal Service Committee, which leaves myself chairing the Audit Committee, Armando and Tina working with me on that committee. So those are the committee assignments I nominate and would make a motion for the board to approve. Is there any discussion before we ask for a second?
I'll second, Bill. It's Gilbert.
Okay, thank you, Gilbert. Anybody opposed to these assignments?
So wait, let me ask you a question. Does that mean I'm doing the audit committee for another year?
Yes.
Okay.
Bill, this is Alan. Do you need more people on the audit committee?
No, we need to have 3 to 5, and we have 3, so we're good. This allowed everybody to have a preference. If next year you'd prefer to be on another committee, we'll have to twist some arms and switch them off, but we'll do that if we need to do that.
If Tina, for example, didn't want to do another year on audit, I mean, I'd be happy to switch out just wherever I'm needed.
This is Alan, right?
Yes.
Okay. Tina, are you willing to serve for another year? We got the audit coming up. You've been on all year.
Because the audit's coming up, I will serve another year. I just was hoping to serve on other committees going forward.
Okay, let me know.
The importance of staying on for the next year.
Okay. And we can revisit this then after the audit's completed this year and shift around. I don't think this is something we can do at any time. So let's complete it this way through the audit, and then we'll readdress it. Okay. We got Gilbert moved it. I'll second it. Does anybody oppose? Okay, we're approved. Okay, next, Kelly, are we on to Lone Star at this stage? Kelly?
I was on mute. We are on to, we're on to Lone Star, yes, and we may not, if there's no questions, we may be able to cover this in open session. And then the only other open items would be executive director's report and the supplemental meeting.
Okay.
But let's see how the Lone Star goes, if we can do it in open or if we need to go to closed session for that.
Okay, let's go ahead. Who is Kent going to give us
This is Kent. So it's not unusual for private equity funds to need extensions, as they end their normal investment period or fund term. Lone Star has been a little bit different case. We're keeping a closer eye on it. And so you see on slide 285 of John, one up, that we've had a series of six-month extensions. There are two funds that are in their extension period, Lone Star Growth Capital and Lone Star CRA. We have evaluated, our position here. It's better for all parties if we kind of maintain the normal fund structure rather than kind of not extending. It's to our benefit in any kind of situation. And so that's why we've continued to extend these or recommend extending them as we've gone through, as we move forward through time. And so our current extension has expired, and we're recommending that we continue with another six-month extension on Lone Star Growth Capital and Lone Star CRA.
Questions?
Bill?
Yep. Questions? Somebody start talk. Mark, was that you?
No, it was not me.
I'm sorry. Anybody have any questions? I mean, this is an ongoing situation, staff, and is working hard on it, but I think the view is that we need to keep it as an active fund. We don't want to get into a dissolution thing at this point. So we've got somebody want to move? I'll move that we make the extensions recommended by staff. We have a second on that?
Alan, second.
Alan, second. Thank you, Alan. Anybody opposed? Okay. Nope. It passes then. Okay, Kelly, you had your report, executive director's report?
Yeah. It's a pretty standard report. The monitoring reports that you receive every month are included with the packet or at the attached link. As far as open records requests go, we've received 3 since the last board meeting. 2 of those were complete. One of them is also complete, but we declined to provide the information they requested because they requested information about individual members' benefits, which we cannot provide. But in as far as we're concerned, those are all complete. COVID response, we're still working remotely. Occasionally, employees will go into the office as needed. We are answering calls live and with a receptionist, so there's somebody in the office for people to come in, and calls aren't going to voicemail, those types of things. But that's really all I have under the executive director's report.
Okay.
Hey, Kelly, this is Ken. I got one question on open records.
Uh-huh.
When we say no to someone, do we have to send that information to the AG's office and the AG has to say, yeah, you were right, or do we just say no and that's it?
It depends on the reason for the no. Some no's, like this one where they wanted individual information, we're able just to say no. But sometimes, and if you need more information, you know, Josh can tell you, but sometimes if we are not going to provide it, then the AG has to give us an opinion on that. But this one is clear in the law that we don't have to.
Cut and dry. Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. I think that brings us to the end of the open session for any of the members that are out there. Well, go ahead, Kelly. Were you going to correct me?
No, I didn't have anything to say. I think you're correct.
Okay. So what we're going to do now, and I'm not sure we have any legal issues, but in the event that something has come up, we're going to go into closed session under 551.071 on the code to meet with get advice from our outside counsel and our internal counsel, and then we will go into a medical committee meeting. I don't expect we will get back out into open session other than to adjourn. So for people on there, this is probably a good time to get off the call, unless you want to hang on. I don't know how long we'll be. We could be 20, 30 minutes or longer, but it's up to you. And then we'll come back and do the supplemental meeting. So with that, we will end the open session and go into closed session. John, let us know when we're clear to do that.
Will do.
Thank you, everybody. This is Leah. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you, Leah. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're clear to go into the closed session.
Okay, we've got Chuck with us.